Support for KDLG comes from the Spruce Kitchen in Dillingham, located by the PAF Yard. Open Tuesday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 7 p.m., serving lunch, dinner, and takeout. More information at facebook.com/thesprucekitchen or 842-4453.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, April 21st. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Glad to have you with us as each week coming up.
Really what you have between the House and the Senate right now is competing visions for what the future of the state is going to look like. I mean, that's how momentous this whole fiscal discussion really is.
Speaker Bryce Edgemond sits down for an update while the legislature takes a quick breather. We'll visit with the Nature Conservancy, which has secured an in-stream water flow reservation at Lower Tularet Creek, and get some details about why Dillingham's 3 million pounds of annual trash has been so costly to deal with lately.
It costs about the same per year if we buried everything, instead of burning the incinerator and burying one-third. The challenge, though, is the available space that we have goes away much, much quicker.
And ahead of Earth Day tomorrow, some youngsters get all science-y on us.
Did you know if you put hot air in a plastic bottle and put it in cold water, it'd implode?
That's all coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. Last Saturday, Vice President Mike Pence made a stop in Anchorage to meet with Governor Bill Walker. The governor said the two mostly discussed the state's trade relations with Asia, where Pence was headed for the week. Walker also spoke about the state's natural resources and its strategic location for military operations. Just 2 days later, a pair of Russian bombers flew past the coast of Alaska, triggering a launch of U.S. fighter jets from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to intercept. A second pair of bombers was tracked by NORAD again on Tuesday. This time, the military just monitored them, says Captain Anastasia Schmidt.
Different circumstances warrant different responses. I can't really get into specifics about each of those potential responses. However, not launching F-22s, not doing an intercept, was deemed the most appropriate response in this situation.
No Russian military planes had been intercepted since July 4th of 2015, but military officials in the state say this is within the realm of normal behavior near the shared border. Boguslaw volcano was restless again this week, but so far has not exploded again. Several small earthquakes shook the area over the weekend. Since December, the Aleutian Island volcano near Dutch Harbor has blown 37 times, dramatically changing the size and shape of its island. On Saturday, a plane registered to a Naknek man and flown by a King Salmon man crashed on the Parks Highway, with the pilot walking away with only minor injuries. State troopers said 51-year-old Ronald Scott Hernandez hit power lines crossing the road as he attempted an emergency landing. The Cessna 182 ended up on its nose in a ditch along the road. A new assistant district attorney is taking over duties in Dillingham. Dan Doty was in town this week as he gets settled in. He's a 2013 William & Mary Law School grad who started his career as a state's prosecutor in Bethel.
I worked there in Bethel for a little over 2 years before I started working in private practice in Anchorage. I did that for a year, then worked at the municipal prosecutor's office in Anchorage for a little while before the state reached out to me and told me that they would like somebody with rural experience out here running the office here in Dillingham.
He and his wife are planning to move to town next month. Doty takes over duties from Pamela Dale, who had been assigned to the Dillingham Court criminal cases since early 2016, but lived mostly in Anchorage. The Department of Fish and Game flew its first survey of the Togiak Herring Grounds Monday after a pilot reported possibly seeing some fish out there. Tim Sands wrote in his report that there were no signs of herring just yet and that the recent sea surface temperature mapping has not indicated a warming change yet. Sands was going to fly again today, but a spotter pilot for one of the processing companies was in the air and said he saw no herring today. Fish and Game is still predicting an early May fishery. The first ever Bristol Bay Fish Expo is being planned for June in Naknek. Katie Copps Wilson is helping organize the event, which will be modeled after the Pacific Marine Expo that happens each November down in Seattle.
A lot of the locals can't afford to go to the Pacific Marine Expo, one, as visitors, or two, as being able to afford a booth down there. And so that's our hope, is to provide that place for the little guys to come and advertise their wares and still have the same market available.
Proceeds from renting space at the expo will benefit the Little Angels Child Care Academy in Naknek. The event is scheduled for June 9th and 10th at the Bristol Bay Borough School. The Dillingham City Council voted to increase the harbor stickers for commercial fishing boats based on the recommendation of the Port Advisory Committee. Harbor Master Gene Barrett says 2 years ago, most of the port tariffs were increased 20%, but not the drift boats.
In 2014, the price for a 32-foot boat was $260. It went up to $280. So it was only a $20 increase instead of a 20% increase. So this year we put we added another 14% on top of that, bringing it up to $320 for a vessel, which is basically $10 a foot.
Barrett says the increases are in keeping with rising cost of operations at the harbor that at times can house up to 450 fishing boats. And the Nooshigak Cooperative has named its new CEO. Bob Hemshute will take over from Mike Megley, who was serving as the interim. Board President Pete Andrews says Hemshute, who is a past Dillingham City Council member and longtime employee of telecom giant GCI, will be a good fit for the job.
Bob is very familiar with rural Alaska. He's had great working relationship with different cooperatives in the state and being able to pull people together to get missions done for the betterment of folks. And he knows what the conditions are like. He knows what situations are like. And I think that we'll have a good fit with Bob.
Hemshute and Megley will transition by June 1st. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. The state's elected officials are taking a quick breather this weekend. The first session of the 30th legislature has gone past 90 days, and things were getting a little heated as competing ideas from the House and Senate inched their ways forward. Bryce Edgman is the Speaker of the House and sat down this morning for the latest. Mr. Speaker, good to have you back in the studio.
My pleasure, Dave. Good to be here.
What brings you to town? Why is the legislature not in session on this Friday here?
Well, we got to a point in the legislature where, with the inclusion of the 90-day limit, people were transitioning out of their apartment rental leases and moving cars back home and just sort of preparing themselves for the next phase of things in Juneau. And it was also a point where I think a lot of legislators, myself included, had put in many days consecutively and long hours, and we frankly needed a little bit of time away, to reconnect with families, constituent communities, kind of check back in with the outside world. And so I think that goes for both the House and the Senate.
The politics seem to be getting pretty hot down there lately, and the House has advanced its comprehensive plan to meet the crisis. The Senate is working with a different set of numbers or proposals anyway. I think Alaskans are ready to see the two bodies come together and really start hashing out what's going to get passed. How close is that?
Well, we talk regularly, we being the House, the Senate, the governor and his budget officials. So the dialogue has been ongoing. It's been very consistent. And that, to me, is a basis for optimism in itself. But really what you have between the House and the Senate right now is competing visions for what the future of the state is going to look like. I mean, that's how momentous this whole fiscal discussion really is. What the House is proposing is a plan that would essentially get her done this year. We would provide, put into place the framework for having a balanced budget in 3 years. And that includes broad-based revenues, which has been very controversial, whereas the Senate, on the other hand, primarily wants to restructure the permanent fund, which is about a two-thirds fix, keep a structural deficit of, pick a number anywhere from $800 to $900 million to $500 million going out in the future, and then sort of have their plan predicated on oil prices doing X, Y, and Z, oil production doing the same, the stock market performing at about a 7% a year clip, and then meanwhile cutting the budget further, which greatly troubles me as a rural legislator. So you've got these two different plans that in some respects are both built around restructuring the permanent fund. That's the bigger chunk of it all. But then when you get beyond that point, we in the House say, let's do it all this year because next year is an election year, and we've proven that the legislature doesn't do heavy lifting during election years. So if we don't do it this year, then we're kicking the can down the road at least till 2019. And at that point, we've already spent a good chunk of whatever savings we have left. So that's sort of a big picture view of what's happening in Juneau.
Two components of the House plan that the Senate doesn't seem too keen on yet is the income tax and oil and gas tax credit reforms or reworking. Do you see any chance that the Senate leadership will buy into the House proposals?
I think in the end we are going to find common ground on reforming oil tax credits, which I think everybody agrees, at least to some extent, are unsustainable. We just simply can't continue providing cash outlays. The bigger issue with oil tax credit reform is the incentives that are embedded in the tax formula that the bigger companies in particular are paying and in essence are having their annual amounts owed to the state reduced. So I think we're going to find some common ground there in the end. On the issue of the school tax, as we call it in the majority coalition, basically built around individuals paying a very modest amount on an annual basis. That's a whole different dynamic. You know, again, I go back to what we in the House believe. We think we need to balance the budget this year, take major steps so that we have the budget balanced in a couple of years. And then in doing so, provide a capital budget, be able to account for inflation eating into the purchasing power of every government dollar that goes out there. And really, more importantly, to help lift the state out of this economic recession that we're now in. And I think we're poised to even go deeper in the future. So we're, in my view, in the House, taking the longer-term view of things, and we're looking out for the best interest of the state. And in order for our state to succeed, it has to grow. If it doesn't grow, if it continues to shrink.
You're not talking about growing government. You're talking about growing
the
state.
Overall economy. And thank you for that clarification, because the linchpin or the driver in that is state government spending, even though there are a lot of other components, of course, that come into economic wealth on a statewide basis, federal spending and industry activity and things of that nature.
Well, it seems like it's a discussion that's happened now for at least 2 years, if not three or four, but will certainly come to a head in the weeks ahead. And nobody wants to see you in session in the summer, but what's the likelihood that you can wrap up business within the 120 days?
Well, I'm optimistic, and I think that the resolve to take major steps is there this year in the legislature, and it's crossing most of the political boundaries down there, not all, but most. I'm optimistic that we can get something done this year and set the stage for Alaska not having to worry about where things are going to be in the next 10, 15, 20, 25 years in terms of not only our economy, our smaller communities, but our sustainability as a whole.
Speaker of the House, Bryce Edgman, good to have you in the studio, and thanks for the time as always.
Dave, it's good to be here in person. Thank you.
And we'll have more from that interview posted online with this show later today at kdlg.org. Back in a moment. Regular KDLG listeners will know this little ditty.
Did you know everyone is expected to sort their garbage? The incinerator just can't handle the glass in cans. It clogs up the vents, damaging the incinerator.
What should we do?
Well, first you separate glass and cans, but you don't have to separate plastic.
That song now haunts my dreams at night. Thank you, Janice. Well, the reason the city paid to advertise that bit of information on KDLG is because its trash problems continue to pile up. Both the amount of trash collected and the cost to deal with it have both increased annually. Just one part of the city's expected $1 million deficit next fiscal year. There are likely to be some landfill fee increases. The city is pleading with its residents to sort their garbage to help out. And there will not be any free dump days for residential trash this spring as part of the annual community cleanup. We dispatched Lawrence Hamilton for a guided tour of the issues. He filed this report.
Walking across the active cell, that's the name for the place where the trash is buried, at the Dillingham landfill was like seeing the whole history of people's lives. Children's toys, SimCity DVDs, Powerade bottles, and old ratty shirts covered in oil stains are just part of what is visible. Being this early in the year means there is still quite a bit of snow on the ground, which buries a lot of the trash and keeps the smell down. It also made me wonder what else could be under there. What's the strangest thing you ever found out here?
That wouldn't be appropriate for the radio.
That was Dillingham Public Works Director Ken Morton. It is his job to handle the 3 million pounds of trash that arrive at the landfill annually. Morton talks me through the process of filling the cell with trash, most of which is burnt first in the incinerator.
This is our active cell. We are burying the ash from the incinerator operation, which you can see over there. And this is some of what came in that we were not able to run through the incinerator.
To contain the trash, the cell is surrounded by berms, or raised banks.
You can see the berms along the edge. We've been building that up over the winter in order to extend the life of this facility, of this cell.
Once the trash is dumped in the cell, it needs to be compacted down.
That's our compactor. It's actually a pretty heavy piece of equipment. We will run that over the waste once it's placed in order to pack it down. And then the fill that's right behind us, that is what we use for cover.
But the problem is, the cell is nearly full.
At this location here, I suspect we have another year of operational life.
So now Morton and his staff are planning on adding a new cell over summer.
We need to get that constructed and move our operation over there. This next cell is to have three phases and should last 45 years.
Morton then took me on a tour of the incinerator room.
The conveyor that you see that rotates here, you'd be surprised at how something will get jammed up and the system will quit rotating.
Basically, trash that is not properly sorted can make an already costly operation even more expensive and frustrating. While you might think something like a small piece of pipe in your trash won't do any harm, it can block the conveyor belt and cause big problems. But it is the everyday glass and cans and unsorted trash that create the biggest challenge.
Glass and metal creates problems operationally with the incinerator. It reduces its efficiency, requires us to embank more when it's down, and increases operation costs.
But compared to previous years, Morton believes the incinerator is doing its job.
If you could have seen what it looked like last summer compared to now, you'd be very impressed.
That is one way of looking at the incinerator, and Morton acknowledges that people around the community might have differing views on how the landfill spends its money. The incinerator is currently eating almost three times as much oil as originally planned. Despite this, Morton still thinks the incinerator is indispensable.
It costs about the same per year if we buried everything, instead of burning the incinerator and burying one third. The challenge, though, is the available space that we have goes away much, much quicker.
The problem of trash is not new, and rural communities have had to evolve their solutions to meet changing regulations. In 1996, the Department of Environmental Conservation banned the practice of open burning of general trash, which eventually led to the purchase of the incinerator in 2015. If the rules changed in 1996, why, you may ask, did it take until 2015 for Dillingham to purchase an incinerator? Here's Morton with the explanation.
Well, the rules changed in 1996.
Yeah.
And again, DEC, the regulatory agency that is focused on this, they worked on the larger landfills first. And as they brought those landfills into compliance, they stretched their gaze further out.
That meant that Dillingham fell within the DEC's gaze and had to fall in line. Dillingham City Manager Rose Loetta acknowledges the benefits of the changes.
Before, when I drive home, if it was calm and we were doing open burning, you'll see a blue flume just hovering in the air, which isn't good for the neighbors there.
The DEC also requires testing of the site.
We have to do methane testing. I can't remember what that costs. We were having to test the ash coming out of the incinerator, and that was a couple thousand a test a month. So we're looking easily at, between the permit fees and the testing requirements, close to $100,000 just to operate.
So far, the landfill is up and passing all of its required tests, but the costs keep mounting and the budget keeps shrinking. Make no mistake, the future of the landfill is a big and expensive issue. The projected operating budget for 2017 is $764,000, and according to a report issued by the city, the landfill operations are heavily subsidized by the city general fund. With the annual cost of running the incinerator touching six figures, and annual environmental testing along with wasted production over lack of sorting, as well as the need for constant growth and development of the landfill, it is an issue that is not going away anytime soon.
First you separate glass and cans, but you don't have to separate plastic.
In Dillingham, I'm Lawrence Hamilton.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yaggity yak!
Don't go back.
Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom.
The Nature Conservancy announced this week that it has been granted by DNR a water rights reservation for Lower Tulare Creek.
It's rich for sport fishing. It is a great sockeye salmon producer. It's been very, very important over time for subsistence uses. So all those things together said, hey, this is really a fisheries gem, and it's worthy of protecting the lands around it as well as the water in it.
That's Rand Hagenstein, the Nature Conservancy's Alaska State Director. The nonprofit organization appears to be the first of its kind to receive the state's reservation of in-stream water rights, which has taken since the mid-90s to see completed. Hagenstein joins us now for more on this. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Why was this an important initiative for the Nature Conservancy? And this goes back a long ways here. This is not like a recent let's do something to throw up roadblocks to development up there. This goes back decades.
Yeah, you know, this does go back a long, long ways. So about 22 years ago, when I first started with the Nature Conservancy here in Alaska, we were doing a project to buy a piece of land at the mouth of Lower Tulare Creek. Really, really important sport fishing location. And after we did that, we got talking to folks at the Department of Fish and Game and realized that the framers of the Constitution had put in place a really, really innovative piece of law that relates to water rights. Most states give people the opportunity to just pull water out of streams for different uses. But Alaska has a really unique provision in that it lets organizations, individuals, corporations the opportunity to reserve water in a stream. And one of the primary uses is for fish and wildlife habitat protection. So we decided to work with the Department of Fish and Game back in about 2000, I think, maybe even a few years prior to that, to see what this provision is all about. And so we embarked on a project to document the flows in Lower Tulare Creek and submitted an application, about, I think, 16 or 17 years ago now, to reserve enough water in the stream to meet the needs of salmon and trout in perpetuity.
16 or 17 years to get this application processed. I suspect that's not just because the state moves this slow. There must have been other hurdles along the way.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, the state has had a long-term backlog in water rights applications. And so they've tended to prioritize those applications to draw water out of streams for different industrial and resource development uses and put the in-stream flow applications at a lower priority. As this thing all played out, and bear in mind, there's a lot of work that's required to successfully do an in-stream flow application. You need 5 years of flow data, in essence, to prove up on your application. So, you know, we went through all that. So that takes a certain amount of time. But DNR did have a backlog in terms of processing through these claims. In the meantime, the issue of the proposed pebble mine comes up, and a number of other organizations realize that there's some potential power in using in-stream flow reservations to secure enough water for salmon and trout and other species. For a time, it got sort of swallowed up in a piece of legislation, House Bill 77, that would have restricted the ability of organizations or non-governmental entities to secure in-stream flow reservations. That bill ultimately did not proceed, and in large part because of concern about the restrictions on who could apply for and hold water rights.
Now, I remember there was a huge backlash there during that legislative session, including from a number of folks here in Bristol Bay. When you get this level of protection from the state, can you explain for the layman amongst us, what does that actually do?
So what it does is it gives you the right to ensure that a certain amount of water stays in a stream. Now, that's not a right that can't be taken away at the discretion of the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So in some ways, it's not as secure an ownership right as, say, owning a piece of property. But at a minimum, it does provide documentation on what fish and wildlife need for water to be held in a stream. And it gives you a seat at the table should other parties come and say, hey, we need to draw water out of that system. So it provides an opportunity, I think, for a higher level of engagement in specific issues around a stream.
The Nature Conservancy counts this as a success, not only just for Lower Tulare Creek protection, but also perhaps as an example that nonprofits could replicate this. I think you're the first in the state to do this.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And that really was the original intent, was to put our toe in the water, if you will, if you'll pardon the bad pun, and test what does it take to secure an in-stream flow reservation and establish this as a pilot project that, you know, we could replicate or others could replicate.
Rand, it's been good to talk to you. Thanks so much for this update on the inflow stream reservation on Lower Tulare Creek that's been secured by the Nature Conservancy. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been great visiting with you today.
Finally, this week in our overtime segment, Earth Day has been celebrated each April 22nd since 1970. This year, folks are organizing marches for science all around the country, including 10 spots here in Alaska. Devin Lisick is helping organize Dillingham's event.
The March for Science is a celebration of the Earth. It's a celebration of what we do every day at home, at work, at school. It's not just a scientist in a lab coat, and we need to stand up for science. It's not a political march, but there is a lot of background politics that go around with it, and we need to celebrate the Earth and the national parks and the Sea Grant and all that.
Well, events get underway at the Bristol Bay campus tomorrow at 11. Some fourth and fifth graders have also been preparing for Earth Day, and we asked them to research some scientific facts and share them with us here.
I'm Nicolina Wolvik. My age is 11 years old. And did you know when helium is cooled to the lowest temperature possible, it becomes a liquid with surprising properties? It flows against gravity and will start running up and over the lip of the glass.
Tyler Tucker, 11. Lightning is around 27 degrees Celsius. That is 6 times hotter than the sun.
Shante Hayano, 10. 41 new species are discovered by scientists every single day.
Sulfate Kapotikin lasers can get trapped in a waterfall.
I'm Jesse Sage, I'm 11. And did you know Earth's rotation's gradually slowing?
My name's Faye Calvert and I'm 10 years old.
Did you know that the adult human skeleton has 206 bones?
My name is Braxton Peters, and I'm 10. Did you know your fist is as big as your heart?
I'm Charlene Savo, and I'm 11, and my fact is the known universe is made up of 500 million galaxies.
My name is Robin Savo. I'm 11 years old, and I found out that when you pop your knuckles, instead of gas bubbles popping, they're actually being formed.
Hi, my name is Aurora Plant. Did you know that your muscular system is made up of more than 600 muscles, and I'm 10 years old?
Hello, my name is Lainey Woods. I am 10 years old. Did you know that if you lined up your small intestine, it would be about the length of a basketball court?
My name is Bradley Wilson. I'm 10 years old. Did you know that a grasshopper can jump 10 times their own length?
Hey, Ronald Schultz, 11. Earth is the only planet that's not named after a god. Tell me, where do the children
play? My name is Nalene Vala, and I'm 10, and my science fact is, did you know if you put hot air in a plastic bottle and put it in cold water, it'll implode?
Hi, my name is Carl Larson. My age is 10. Did you know your veins can go around the world 2.5 times?
Hi, my name is Ivana Keita. Did you know your little intestine is longer than your big intestine?
Hi, my name is Ellie Ishnok. I'm 10. Did you know sound can break glass?
My name is Peyton Johnson, and I am 10. Did you know that an empty can is not an empty can? It's full of air.
My name is Ty Colby. I'm 10. Did you know that your inner ear helps you with your balance?
My name is Graylin Cheney. I'm 10 years old, and did you know that you can levitate objects with sound waves?
Hi, my name is Christina Alexi. I am 9 years old. Did you know that plants are made up of lots of cells?
My name is Kristen Beltran. I'm 12 years old. And did you know most of the dust in your home is mostly dead skin?
Liam Evans, 10. How fast does the Earth move? 30 kilometers per second.
I am Chase Huffman, and I'm 10 years old, and did you know you have about 95 to 100 billion nerve cells in your body?
Kenton Woods, 10. Submarines could go underwater.
Caitlin Bond, I'm 11. Sharks don't have one bone in their body. Instead, they have a skeleton of cartilage.
Thomas Olson, 11. The sun is over 300,000 times larger than Earth.
Anthony Delano, 11. Electric currents is measured in amperes or amps.
Arthur Goya, 12. A child could swim through a vein of a blue whale shark.
Jessica Noden Bocatch, 11. Carnivores only eat meat because they can't digest vegetables and change it into vitamins and amino acids.
Jeffrey Burrito, age 11. The moon weighs 10 to the 21st power.
Jessica Noden Bocatch, 11. Carnivores only eat meat because they can't digest vegetables and change it into vitamins and amino acids.
Raymond Murphy, 11. Gasoline is explosive.
Hi, I'm Dave Benninger, and where else are you going to find so many cool, bold kids on the radio? That's it for this week's show. You can find all 100 of our past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Send feedback and story ideas to dave@kdlg.org. My thanks to Lawrence Hamilton and Avery Lill for their help this week. Hope to see you back here next Friday.
Seem to go, but you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Support for KDLG comes from Silver Bay Seafoods, a fisherman-owned integrated processor of salmon for domestic and export markets. Job opportunities and more at silverbayseafoods.com.